Welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at a landmark Danish film directed by Thomas Vinterberg called The Celebration. Returning on the show today to talk about The Celebration is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So it's funny, the first film we talked about earlier on was Babbitt's Feast, and that's a very positive movie about the goodness in humanity and just bringing everyone together over just some delicious food. This is completely different. A lot of people are coming together, but it just shows just the hidden secrets in the family and just how damaged people can be when somebody just abuses their position. And it's a great movie, but definitely not something you want to keep watching. You're not going to want to watch it over and over again.
It's a good movie. You're glad you saw it once. Yeah, you wouldn't return to it. It's definitely not a feel-good movie. It also doesn't have that feel of Babette's Feast, of that sort of windswept beauty. You know, it's much more everyday.
And you bring up, that helps leads into my next part. This is considered a very landmark film because this was the first Dogma 95 film. And so looking at Dogma 95, this was a bunch of Danish directors, including Lars von Trier, who kind of said, we're not going to be the Hollywood conventions where we're going to be a lot of stylistic stuff. It's going to be just very basic camera work. A lot of it's shot on like videotapes instead of like filmed, so it won't look as pretty looking. There's a lot of very kind of different editing. We're not going to do a lot in the post-production phase. I mean, so tell me a little bit more about Dogma 95.
Well, they decided that this group of Danish directors was to purify filmmaking, basically by not using technical tricks. And so they came up with these 10 rules that they refer to as the vow of chastity. First of all, shooting has to be done on location. Everything that is brought in has to be used in a natural way. So if you rent somebody's house to use for your movie, you have to use it as is. You can't bring in your own lamps. You can't light it differently than it is lit naturally. You can't change a magazine, angle to hide the something or show something. It has to be exactly as is. You can't touch anything. Second of all, the sound must never be produced apart from the images. So you can't have music unless it occurs where the scene is being shot. Camera has to be handheld. The film has to be in color. Optical work and filters are forbidden. The film can't contain superficial action. Murders, weapons, etc. must not occur. Temporal and geographical alienation are forbidden. That is to say, the film has to happen in the here and now. No period pieces. No genre movies. Nothing but Academy 35mm film. And the director must not be credited. And that last one tells you why this did not last very long. Because, of course, the directors wanted to be credited. But those were the rules. And what you end up with is a lot of stuff that looks really like home movies.
Yeah, it looks very rough cut. Like, even when I watched the Lars von Trier film, The Boss of It All, even though that was not a Dogma 95 film, they felt like it, too, because there's a lot of rough cuts. You can tell they don't do a lot of sound editing in post-production. And this movie, it's a lot of rough cuts, and the film almost looked like it was shot like on videotape. It doesn't look nice and clean like something you see in Hollywood.
It has that weird green color that you get when you don't correct the lighting. Mm-hmm. It looks weird, and it's one of the reasons I like to use it in my class because, for one, it shows you, well, without all the artifice, what have you got left? I mean, what are you looking at? And then, does the story hold up? Because that's really all you've got when you take away all of the tricky things that are meant to make the movie look pretty. And after he made the movie, Vinterberg confessed that he actually covered a window during the shooting of one scene. So, he also brought a prop in the set, so that was considered special lighting. So, he violated, from the very first film. It's unforgivable. He covered a window.
Yeah. After listening to all the rules and everything, I understand you don't want to be too stylish and everything, but there's a difference between that and just basic and just causing problems for yourself. If the lighting is like you're doing trying to shoot a scene in a room and it's just too dark or too bright, the color is going to be way off. What's the point? What's so awful about bringing a lighting in and help balancing that out so you can get a good shot?
Right.
Or if you got a mistake or something's in there, and you want to cover it up. What's so bad about that? Or if like a location, it just doesn't has this little area that just isn't practical. What's so bad about doing it in the studio? I mean, just looking at these rules, it seems like I mean, there's a difference between trying to be pure and just like putting way too many obstacles for yourself.
I think they wanted to take the Italian neorealism to the next level. Because they started off with, well, we don't need all of these Hollywood tricks. We don't need studios. We don't need famous actors. We just need cameras, regular folks, and natural lighting. And we'll just go out on the street and do movies about real people. And this kind of takes it to the next level. Like, okay, well, we'll do all that real stuff. But why don't we also, like, make sure there's everything's like a current topic and make sure that, you know, you're also not using all these tricky lenses that we have now. So it's, I think in a way it's neorealism taken to the next level.
Or even like the French New Wave. Like, remember a long time ago we talked about Breathless and we talked about how when they're shooting scenes in Paris, like they're not getting any permits or anything. They're just doing it like right there. And you can see people like, well, what are these cameras doing here? So it's even like that where it's just like the French Wave with the guerrilla style filmmaking. You could definitely see this in that movie too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also this desire to try something new. Let's try something that hasn't been done and see what happens, you know. We can always change it, which, of course, everyone eventually abandoned the dogma way of doing things. But it was kind of, you know, a way to try to be different, try to look at film in a new way. And what my students enjoy about watching it is how much you realize how ingrained things are. One of the things they always mention is the fist fight that occurs. Sounds like people actually fighting instead of the Hollywood, you know, where they really make it sound so much more significant. But, you know, real people fighting sounds different than the way Hollywood usually shoots it. And that comes across really well in the movie because it looks real.
And it's, it's never as well choreographed or awesome looking as it is in the movie.
Yes, that too.
And so then I got to ask you, with all of this bit of experimentation and editing style, and even there's a lot of, you know, unique camera angles, like things are shot at from a certain angle or, you know, either Dutch angle, no pun intended, but, you know, just a lot of different stuff. Did it distract you, or when your students watch it, does it distract them to say, like, what, you know, that's a little bit too much of that? Or
I think since the subject of the movie is someone's birthday party, it feels, all of these tricks feel, or lack of tricks, feel like somebody making a home movie. And I think that's what works about it. The fact that it looks like somebody was doing it for a home movie makes it look like you interrupted a home movie and this was what happened. The interesting thing about what you mentioned, though, about them, you know, they're trying not to do all these tricky things, but in order to have everything be handheld, they had to do all these tricky things. So when Christian falls to the floor in the reception and sees his sister, Ulrich Thompson himself had to hold the camera while falling.
Really?
And then to achieve that dizzy sound, the original cameraman swung the microphone around in the air. You know, so they had to, and at the table where everybody's sitting, they eventually had to let some of the guests at the table hold the cameras because everything had to be handheld and you couldn't get some of those angles unless you did stuff like that.
So you talk about how, you know, you see the movie at the beginning, you see it's going to be a birthday party. With the first 20 minutes of this movie before, like, we figure out what's actually going on and what the actual plot is, it seems like it's most like a, look at this wacky, dysfunctional family getting together for the 60th birthday of their father. What craziness will ensue? Tune in. And because it's like the one guy's, you know, has this dysfunctional relationship with his wife, and he leaves his kids behind so he can take his brother in the car. The one woman's going, you know, having her driver drive just completely recklessly. It just seems like it's just going to be a, you know, comedy. And then when you feel the story kicks in, that it's nowhere near a comedy. And that was just interesting. The first 20 minutes, you think it's going to be one thing, and then the rest of the movie, it's completely different.
You know, the film's been labeled by many critics as a black comedy, but for Vinterberg, it was never meant to be a comedy at all. But people laugh at the cruelty of the film.
Interesting. So just how whenever the son brings up, like, well, my father did this to me, and he did this to me, and just everybody just says, stays silent for a little bit, and they go, hey, remember that? You know, they completely act like they deny what happened.
Yeah, for a while, until things escalate. Now, I've heard from my friends who actually live in Denmark that if you go to any sort of get-together and you bring two index cards and you say, well, I've got two speeches, you know, which one should I read? The whole room will just, you know, be aghast because everybody has seen the movie. So they know what that means. Yeah, it's like, oh no, what are you going to reveal? So if you want to punk somebody in Denmark,
just do that.
Bring two different index cards. Say you're going to give a speech.
So we've been talking about the comedic elements in the film. Knowing what the subject matter is about of pedophilia and the father molesting his children, do you feel that the comedic elements, even though most of it was in the beginning before we know the story, do you feel that they were inappropriate considering the subject matter, or do you feel that since the story really didn't kick in, it wasn't that big a deal?
I think it's meant to be more slice of life. I mean, Vinterberg says that this movie is a drama and there are some laughs, because that's how life is. You know, even in the most serious situation, there's usually some moments of levity or somebody not taking it seriously. But I did want to ask you about the two cards. What do you think was on the other index card?
I always just assumed that he was going to say the same thing for
me
each.
Too.
Okay. As I figured, you know, he's not going to I figured he was sort of tricking his father, because I think he was saying that how he would choose one of his, either him or his sister. So that was just saying, you know, choose one of these just like you used to choose me or my sister.
Good one. That's really good. One of the things I'll ask my students to think about after the film is what was on the other card.
Mm-hmm. And so when I was reading about it, the film was praised. One of the psychologists who deals with men who were sexually abused as children. They talk about the character of Christian was a very accurate portrayal of men who have been abused as children. And I think he gave a great performance. And from what I've heard, this is very accurate and true to, you know, people who have had to deal with this.
Ulrich Thompson always takes the dark role. You know, he's done movies about Danish movies about drug addiction and in Brothers, which we'll talk about in a couple weeks' time. He plays this great guy who is changed forever by something that happens in the war. Very, very terrific actor. But he does like the dark. He does like the dark side.
Brothers. Didn't they remake that with Natalie Portman and Tobey Maguire?
Yeah, terrible remake.
Okay.
The original's outstanding.
Okay, I was like, who was in that movie?
Jake Gyllenhaal. It's Tobey Maguire. I mean, heavy hitters.
Yeah, I haven't seen it, but I heard it was just eh.
We'll get to that. Okay, when we talk about Brothers, we'll compare and contrast.
And it was interesting. I was reading about the inspiration for the film. Vinterberg was telling how he came up with this story because he heard something similar to this on the radio. Somebody was telling the story about, you know, him and his father and at this birthday party. Now, from later readings, it was revealed that this guy made it up and he's in a mental institution or something. But it's just interesting that was his inspiration for coming up with the story.
True. The guy who made the story up, though, adopted the story from a true life experience of a Danish nurse. She held her speech on Christmas Eve.
Mm.
So that must have been quite the blow up.
Yeah. And we talk about Christian, his other brother, Michael. It was interesting because it almost feels like he gives an arc where, you know, he's a better guy at the end. But I still don't, I still didn't like the guy at the end. Okay, true, he finally figures out what his dad done. But he's still incredibly racist. He still said horrible things to his sister's black boyfriend. And he's had enough. He's cheated on his wife with a maid. And then he beats the maid up when it's almost feels like he thinks she's going to reveal the truth. And he beats her up. And after he does that, that whole storyline is completely dropped. So I still didn't like the guy at the end.
Yeah. He was just a nasty character all the way through. But I think it's significant that the main character, Ulrich Thompson's name is Christian, and that the bad brother who should be, you know, we don't know what happened with him and the dad. We don't know if the father abused him, but he's, you know, his name is Michael, and isn't that one of the archangels? Mm-hmm. So there's some religious symmetry happening there. I don't know if it's intentional or not, but I think it's there if you want to see it.
Yeah, I think we figured out, because he did say to him when they're throwing him out, and he says, you didn't know because, you know, they had you sent away to a prep school or something, a private school or whatever. I think he was saying that for some reason he chose not to do this to Michael. And so by doing that, he would send him away so he wouldn't, like, figure out what is going on with Christian and the sister Linda.
You know, the other thing that I think is interesting about the setup, And, you know, because you mentioned that was based on something Vinterberg heard on the radio that wasn't even true. I don't think this is an unusual story. I think there are a lot of people who have family secrets that never come out. Mm-hmm. And somebody is always thinking, you know, one of these days, I am just going to speak my mind and finally
reveal.
Yeah. So I think that's one of the reasons why it's sort of a everyman story. Not really. God, I hope this is an everyman story. Not. But there is an element of that. You know, I'm going to call out, you know, somebody who is being afforded a lot of respect and no one understands what they really, who they really are.
Who they really are, yeah. You can definitely see that because there's always somebody who, even like a similar scene in the movie was a film called Road to Perdition. Mm-hmm. And Paul Newman's this gangster and he's given this big wake to this guy that's done. Little does anybody know that he's the guy that killed him. But anyway, one of the brothers of the dead guy, you know, he starts off a speech and saying, "You're so great," and everything. And he's like, nobody really knows who you really are. And before he starts really laying into him, they kind of shuttle him outside and like, let's get back to party. So it felt similar to that scene in this movie.
Yeah, and also the Michael character, if you think about it, he's also exposed, not to everybody, but certainly to the viewer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everyone's secrets come out. Everybody's bad sides are revealed.
Yeah, and it's sort of, the father sort of suggests that, you know, he may have had an improper relationship with his sister because they've been so close. And he's had, you know, because of what's happened to him, he's probably can't be in a relationship with any woman or be intimate with her anyway because he's just too damaged.
Mm-hmm.
And so, sticking with the theme of Christian, do you feel that he gets a happy ending at the film? That it's the truth is finally exposed and everybody sees who his father really is? Like, there's the scene when he tries to sit down at the dinner table and they say, "We can't eat with you here. You need to leave." And he has that, and, you know, there's this relationship between him and the maid, Pia, and they seem to be together. And at the end, he says, "Do you want to come live with me in Paris?" So do you feel that now that the truth is finally out and everybody sees who his father really is, do you feel that he's able to move on with his life?
Well, I think the truth is powerful, and I think we are at least meant to think that is the result. That was a tough thing to do and blew the whole family apart, not to mention ruin the party. But there is something about speaking the truth to power. That maybe not everything that happens after, maybe not all the consequences are good, but on the whole, you know, at least you're not carrying that secret anymore.
So do you think now that he's got that monkey off his back, so to speak, now that he has somebody who cares for him that he's going to be with, you feel that he's going to go on to live happily ever after or just be happier in his life?
That's what I want to think. But it is Ulrich Thompson, and he always goes to the dark side. So when you see him in another movie, you're like, well, yeah, it didn't really get better for him. He's still got problems.
So we'll talk a little bit about the reception of this film. Now, we've been talking a lot about early on about how it started this Dogma 95 movement, because this was the very first one. Because of this film and was positively received, did a lot of people say, hey, we can do Dogma 95 too. We can make a movie with all these limitations and everything and still make a really good movie. Did this kind of inspire others to take part in this movement?
Yeah, several Danish directors toyed with this technique, but it's pretty much fallen by the wayside now. And Vinterberg has been working on other films and has said, they said, well, you're gonna use the Dogma rules. And he says, no, that was, for its time, it was the latest fashion, but now it's just an old dress.
Yeah, I can definitely see just putting that, like I talked earlier, just putting yourself, like every movie like that, I would seem that just gets frustrating. And, you know, if you want to make a little bit of stylish movie, what's so horrible or awful about that?
Yeah, and the artificialness of it is very self-conscious. You can't not notice it. And it does make for that effect on the viewer of you're not entering in the movie so much as watching it and noticing all the things that you think are unsophisticated about it. Like the way the color and the lighting looks off and the way the fight scene sounds dull and a million little techniques like that and the overuse of the handheld camera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just the shot, like the cinematography isn't anything spectacular. You're not going to look like, you don't come out of this film like, wow, what a beautiful shot.
Right, like with all those limitations, look what they did that hasn't been done in any movies before.
Mm-hmm. So Other Dogma 95, have you seen other Dogma 95 films?
There's a movie called Italian for Beginners, which is very, it's a really nice movie. That doesn't sound very complimentary, but it's not a great movie. Mm-hmm. The problem that it has is the issues of the way it looks and sounds. The sound sounds terrible.
Okay.
And the lighting looks bad. It's about a group of people who all decide to take Italian lessons.
Huh.
And they're Danish, and all of the different interactions and stuff, which is great. You get an ensemble cast. You get, something lots of people have done, which is try mm-hmm. to learn a language. But it's so ugly. The movie is so ugly to look at. My students always say, it's just so distracted by the
ugliness
of the movie. I really couldn't enjoy it.
Yeah, that's my big thing. I'm not sure if I could get into this movement a lot. Like, I could do like the French New Wave because they do a lot of cool things with editing and jump cuts. But with this movie, it's a good movie, but it's just, this is not pretty to look at.
Yeah. Now, the boss of it all, I think, is very clever. And it's sort of a different movie. So I think the Dogma rules work a little bit better because you feel like you're watching something edgy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll definitely talk about that movie
because
I have my opinion on it. So going back to the director, Thomas Vinterberg, now I have seen one other film from his. It was called The Hunt.
And yes.
It's similar subject matter, but in a different direction where the guy didn't do it at all. And that's another hard film to watch because it's Mads Mikkelsen. He's fantastic in it.
Fantastic.
And it's hard to watch just because the guy's a good guy and he's done nothing wrong. And because of a little innocent white lie that somebody said that they didn't really think was going to envelop into this because they have no idea. It's his heart because his life gets completely destroyed. And everybody who pretty much loved him and supported him, like, just chastise him and ignore him. And it's just one of the roughest scenes of the movie is he's going to a grocery store just to get some food mm-hmm. and stuff. And he's getting beaten up.
Yes.
And it's hard. Well, I've only seen it once. Maybe I'll watch it again, but it's just hard to watch because this guy just gets, his life just gets destroyed. And there's an in this scene, I don't want to get too spoiler alert, but interesting scene at the end because it's sort of the people finally figure out that he couldn't have done this. He's innocent. It's after like a year later, but he's going on a hunting trip and somebody shoots at him. It's just sort of implying that there's always going to be people who still think that of him, no matter what, no matter how much evidence to the contrary. And it's a great movie, but it's one of those movies, just like this movie, mm-hmm. where you watch it, may not want to watch it again.
I agree with you totally about the movie, about Mads Mikkelsen and about that scene in the grocery store, because it goes on longer than you wanted to. You're like, we get it. They mm-hmm. beat him up. But it really looks like they beat him up.
Yeah, his face is all bloody, and the fact that, he's... I think the point...
It doesn't look like Hollywood beating up, though. Mm-hmm. It looks like somebody really getting a beat down.
Yeah, and I think the fact that it goes on for long, I think that's the point, because it makes you feel uncomfortable. You're just like, oh my God, just how much more can this guy take of just all these people just abusing him?
Yeah. And yet he retains his gentleness, because at the end when, his accuser, when he meets up with them again, he's risen above.
He's not bitter or anything.
Yeah.
At least not towards her, because it's not her fault.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And the fact that he's able to understand that he does not have any resentment or misplaced anger, because like you said, there's people in the town who are never going to believe anything different. You can see that would make some people very bitter.
Mm-hmm. Especially just what they do to him, like once mm-hmm. they kill his dog.
Yeah, I mean, come on. And you knew that poor dog.
Yeah.
They said, I was just, and the fact that his son, he was trying to get custody of his son, there was just so much at stake.
Mm. Yeah, it's a great movie. Other films, these are the only two of his I've seen. I know he did one recently. It was in America. It was called Far From the Maddening Crowd. Have you seen that?
Yes, I did. Yeah, it's okay. He also is working on or just finished Kursk, about the Soviet submarine that sank.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, he's also an interesting guy. He grew up in a commune.
Like a hippie commune?
A hippie commune. So he said, the whole dogma thing where you just say, hey, we're going to do our own thing and, forget the rules. He said it was very easy to
adapt
to until you start making some movies. And like you said, why do you need all these limitations? It's just holding you back creatively.
Okay. So getting closer to my questions here, is there anything else I forgot to talk about that you want to bring up now?
You know, the other actor in the movie that I really like is Paprika Steen. She's a Danish actress, and she's a director, and she's made this movie, The Idiots, and Open Hearts, and a movie called Applause. She's done a lot of stuff. Great actress, and very well
known. Did she play the sister?
Yeah.
Okay. And then, so last question I'll have for you is, you've talked about this a lot, so what was sort of the overall reaction of the students in your class? Because you said like the other film you showed them, are they distracted by its ugliness, so they don't like the film, or they still like it despite all the limitations it puts on itself?
They like seeing what things really look like and really sound like when you're not putting all those effects in. They do like that, and they do mention over and over that it's very much like watching a home movie. But this movie is contrasted with a really wacky movie that I show in class, which is In China, They Eat Dogs. So we talk a little bit about existentialism and self-determination and how at any moment you can decide to do the right thing or the wrong thing. It's not predetermined, because at any time you can make those two choices. We'll talk more about existentialism probably when we talk more about other Danish films. But they are looking for that in this as well.
Okay. All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about Danish director Thomas Vinterberg and his landmark film, The Celebration. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at armchairdirectors.podomatic.com. Esther Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying this family is kaput.